This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Will he or won't he? Elon Musk, by some measures, the richest man in the world, says he wants to buy Twitter, this amazing connective platform that so many of us use for everything from socializing to work to advocacy. But Musk's offer of $44 billion for something that doesn't really have clear value is seeming less likely these days. And that has left us with a lot of questions. Why would Musk care in the first place about buying Twitter? And what would happen if he did buy it? Does all of this even matter that much at all? This whole thing has also left a lot of journalists like me and engaged citizens online wondering what spaces we should be using to have nuanced political conversations online. Think of the debates that we have about platforms like Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or any of the social media platforms that so many people are, well, kind of addicted to. How should these platforms be regulated? What should free speech and expression mean on those platforms, which we didn't have 10, 20 years ago? Do we have to rethink the order of free speech and expression in order to account for social media and all of the different iterations that we are learning so much about? That's where we want to continue the conversation here on Detroit Today, with a discussion not only of Elon Musk and his ambitions to own a big piece of the social media world, but how that connects to these other conversations that we're having about how social media should be shaping the way we talk to each other. How free speech and expression, really cherished values here in our country, should play out on social media platforms. Joining us to help think this through is Will O'Ramus. He writes about technology for the Washington Post and has been covering Elon Musk's bid for Twitter for some time. Will, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks for having me on.
So first, get us up to speed. Elon Musk offered to buy Twitter about a month ago now, and now he's saying maybe he's going to back out of the deal. There are a couple of things that seem to have tripped him up here. Talk about where we are in the narrative of this saga.
Yeah, it's been a lot of twists and turns. Elon Musk is now saying that he is concerned about the amount of bots on Twitter. So that's accounts on Twitter that are probably posting on there and liking things and retweeting things, but they don't represent an actual individual human. They're being controlled or programmed to retweet things or to like things in order to boost somebody else's numbers or clout or voice on the platform. Twitter has said for some time now that they think about 5% of the daily active users they count in their public metrics might be bots. Figuring out which 5% is not easy.
Who's a bot and who's not?
Yeah. And then you know, that number is an estimate, because it's very hard actually to determine what percentage are bots. We know that they're on there. We don't know how many. Musk is using the concern, his apparent concern over the number of bots on Twitter. It feels like he's using that as either leverage to try to negotiate the sale price down from what he agreed to, or maybe back out of the deal. And part of the suspected motivation there is that Twitter's stock, and indeed the broader market, are way down from the price that they were, from the values that they were when he first entered into this agreement. Hmm.
There's also some question about Musk's ability to finance this deal at that price as well. And that has to do with his core business, or one of his core businesses, Tesla. Talk about talk about how he was going to come up with $44 or $45 billion and why he might not actually be able to do that.
Yeah, so Musk is the world's richest person, as you mentioned. He has a paper net worth well upwards of $200 billion, maybe upwards of $250 billion by some estimates. But of course, that's not all just cash in his pocket that he can hand over to Twitter. You know, that's tied up in assets like his stock in his company, Tesla, and his ownership of SpaceX and so on. So his plan to finance this deal of buying Twitter for $44 billion included selling a big chunk of his Tesla stock. And Tesla stock is extremely valuable now. I mean, it's one of the most valuable stocks in the world. He was going to sell a chunk of that to raise the cash. And then he also had lined up some outside investors to help him complete this purchase and to take what has been a publicly traded company on the stock market, you know, with shareholders that may include you and me or our retirement funds and or that sort of thing, to take it private so that he can fully own it, maybe in partnership with these investors. But the market has gone down. The Tesla stock has gone significantly down since he entered into this deal. I think Tesla shareholders aren't thrilled by the fact that he seems to be spending so much time on Twitter now instead of running the electric vehicle company. That's not even to mention all the other companies he's supposed to be running.
So I want to kind of back up here and go to the initial instinct that Elon Musk was indulging here. He wakes up one day and says, you know what? I'm going to buy Twitter. And maybe it wasn't quite that simple, but it did seem to come almost out of nowhere. Talk about what is in his mind, I guess, at that point, and what he thought he might achieve by spending that kind of money, by stretching himself the way that he would have to financially to do that. What is this all about?
I think a few things are at play here. And first, let me stipulate that we don't know for sure what was in Elon Musk's mind.
Of course.
and he doesn't talk to the press very much. He's said a little bit about it, but you always kind of have to take his public statements with a little healthy skepticism, because sometimes his public statements are earnest and other times they seem to be strategic. They're trying to achieve a goal, like manipulating a market, perhaps. So one thing that I think is true about Elon Musk is that this is a guy whose life experience has taught him that he is brilliant and he can do things better than other people, and that whatever he puts his mind to, he can do. And so he's done that with building rockets into space. He's done it with building electric vehicles when people said that couldn't be done. He's made a career out of trying to do things people said couldn't be done. And he looks at Twitter. I mean, this is a site where he spends a lot of time, frankly. I mean, he's a Twitter addict. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see it by the amount he's on there posting and replying and liking things. And so he sees Twitter and he has some problems with how it's being run. Particularly during COVID, he was sort of a, I won't say a COVID skeptic necessarily, but he felt that COVID, the response to COVID was being overdone. And he got upset by Twitter and other social platforms' policies against what they called misinformation. He felt that they were censoring people who were just trying to, you know, express healthy doubt about the response to COVID. In general, he has been frustrated by the sort of progressive push for more politically correct speech, and he doesn't like that. You know, he leans conservative these days. He said in the past he was independent. Now he's saying he'll vote Republican, but he's kind of anti-woke. It's a word that he uses, and so he doesn't like the idea that Twitter was both a movement building platform for people who were trying to build a progressive agenda, but also that Twitter's employees were labeling speech as hate speech or harassment or abuse or that kind of thing, especially by people from the right. So he was frustrated with how Twitter was being run. He figures, I can do it better. He figures, look, I've got all the money in the world. Why don't I just take it over and fix this whole thing?
Yeah. I'm talking with Will Oramus. He's a technology writer for The Washington Post and has been writing about Twitter and Elon Musk, this kind of dance that has unfolded over the last month in which Elon Musk has expressed his desire to own Twitter, said he would pay $44 billion for it. That deal is not yet done and does seem now to be in some jeopardy for a number of reasons. We're talking about what would happen if Elon Musk did buy Twitter. What would that really change on the platform? We're also talking about how that conversation connects to the broader conversation about social media, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, whatever platform you choose. There are some real debates about how those platforms are influencing free speech and expression, also how they protect free speech and expression. These are all really new questions in our culture, given the explosion of social media over the last decade or so. We weren't thinking about this kind of thing in the 2000s, and now it's hard to think of anything else when you talk about dialogue and debate. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well. What do you make of Elon Musk saying he's going to buy Twitter? Are you a Twitter user? Do you like it? Do you have some of the same concerns that Elon Musk has expressed about Twitter and social media? Do you think that we need to do more to make sure they protect free speech and expression? Also give us a call and let us know if you think we ought to be thinking, I guess, a little more broadly about the idea of the public square and how these social media platforms influence that public square, how they shape the public square. Are they the public square right now? And does that mean that we ought to be thinking differently about the way that the government interacts with them? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. We also want to hear from you if you think this is much ado about absolutely not very much. Do you not care about who owns Twitter? Do you not really engage with social media? Do you feel like this is a minority concern in America, and that there are better things that we ought to be spending our time thinking and talking about? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones, and you can go to social media and put comments there as well. Before we get to our callers, Will, I want to put some of those questions to you about how this fits into this debate that we're having about free speech and these platforms. If Elon Musk bought Twitter and did change its policies radically, did allow a lot more speech than the current owners are indulging, what would that do, or what effect would it have, I guess, on this debate about free speech in these platforms? You know, the government has been, I think, kind of sitting back and thinking about how it should be responding and how it might need to regulate these platforms. Would Elon Musk's entry into the conversation accelerate the government's interest, or would it just unleash more experimentation? I mean, would we see other platforms also thinking about free speech in different ways?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I think that we actually already are seeing experimentation in social networks. So some of the dissatisfaction, particularly from the political right in the United States with the policies of Facebook and Twitter and other platforms, has led entrepreneurs to create what they call free speech platforms. There's Rumble, there's Parler, there's Donald Trump's own platform, Truth Social. There's quite a few of these. There's not a shortage of options. The pattern that we've seen play out so far is that when somebody establishes a new network, usually it's kind of along the lines of Twitter. It's usually like a Twitter, but it's supposed to be a place where you can say anything and they won't censor you. Very quickly, the platform becomes overrun with spam, with pornography, with people saying the most offensive things they can just because they can get away with it, right? Like, why do you go to that kind of platform unless it's because you want to say stuff that mm-hmm. you can't say elsewhere? Mm-hmm. And so the platform just becomes this awful experience. I mean, like, nobody really turns out to enjoy being surrounded by the most offensive and loudest people who got kicked out of the, you know, who got kicked out of the respectable place. And so they don't do very well. I mean, they're not, you know, I think it's too early to write them off entirely. Certainly Trump has managed to get lots of headlines for Truth Social and has some people over there, but none of them have really caught on beyond a sort of terminally online conservative fringe of the public. And so it would actually be really interesting to see what would happen to Twitter if Elon Musk were to try to take it in that direction. Now, again, his public statements indicate that that's what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who have been following social media for years and who have seen this pattern play out again and again are skeptical. They think that once Musk saw, you know, if he were to try that, once he saw the results, he would sort of realize his mistake potentially, or maybe he'd be fine with it. You know, and Musk is a bit of a troll himself online. He likes getting a rise out of people, right? He likes owning the libs, so to speak. And so maybe he would enjoy Twitter going back to its roots in a way. I mean, Twitter many years ago prided itself on being, quote, the free speech wing of the free speech party, right? It was the place where you could say anything. And that was why it could play a role in the Arab Spring, because activists could say stuff and the regime couldn't stop them and they could organize. And, you know, but then over the years, as it became clear that Twitter was just a really kind of a scary place for people to be because of all the harassment and the name calling and the doxing and all that kind of thing, they kind of tightened up the reins. So I don't know, you know, would they go back to the beginning again and start that cycle all over if Musk took it over? It is hard to say. I mean, one thing we do know is that he has said he would bring Donald Trump back to the platform. We know he was annoyed in a couple of years ago when Twitter banned a conservative parody outlet called the Babylon Bee. I'm sure mm-hmm. he would bring them back. He's talked to their publisher. I think he would bring back lots of the people who've gotten booted. And I think we've already seen, in fact, the Washington Post did a report recently looking at the data that conservative accounts have seen a boost in their followers since Musk's bid to buy Twitter began, and liberal accounts have seen their followers leave, let the site. So already the site is shifting rightward. And now how far it would go, whether the left would flee entirely, and maybe we would start to see left, you know, liberal versions of Twitter spring up, right? Like the liberal equivalent of the Rumbles and Parlors and Truth Socials.
Okay, coming up next, we're going to continue this conversation with Will Ramis about Elon Musk and Twitter and free speech and social media. We will get to you and your calls on the phones as well as on social media. Frank in Livonia, Alan in Pleasant Ridge, Jason in Macomb County, you'll be up first. If you want to join them, 313-577-1019 is the number. And you can always go to Facebook or to Twitter, which is the subject of our conversation. Put your comments there and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest is Will Ramis, a technology writer for The Washington Post. He's been writing about Twitter and Elon Musk. Will Elon Musk end up buying Twitter? Will he change the platform in a way that we really notice in terms of how it respects free speech, free exchange of ideas? Also, how does that connect to these other conversations we're having about social media platforms? We want to hear from you during the conversation as well. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. You can also go to Facebook or Twitter, put comments there, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Let's start today with Frank in Livonia. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. I just like to say, you know, when you talk about, social media being like a town square, I think a better comparison would be a grocery store. you know, we have an exchange of value, something really important, and they track, you know, your information, you know, what your browsing history say, not just the ads that they make. You know, that's part of their business model. But, you know, if you were to think about a grocery store, you trust them when you go down to buy, you know, Dearborn sausage hot dogs. You trust that grocery store to have actually bought it from Dearborn Sausage, not out of the trunk of somebody's car. God only knows where it came from. You know, you think about when they had the big Tylenol poisoning thing years ago. I mean, the grocery stores, and you know, when they found out about it, they got it off the shelf. But what if they would have just left it on the shelf? And, you know, what if that grocer said, you know, put this stuff out there as being pure product? So I think the, you know, the whole social media thing is, you know, we're not looking at it as a product and an exchange of value. And, you know, so people that are putting stuff out there, you know, they cannot be held responsible directly because they can run their mouth any way they want to. But the platform itself is making money on that. They need to then be treated like the grocer and be held liable for not having pure product on the shelf.
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Well, I guess, you know, and I think that's the thing is that, you know, the social media was protected, you know, by that Clinton-era law that, you know, gave them, you know, certain kinds of protections. But, you know, it's like, you know, when you look at how simple the Truth in Advertising Act is, and even politicians can't hide behind that either because, you know, this freedom of speech thing, because, you know, they're asking for our vote. That's an extremely valuable thing. It has a value much beyond money. So, you know, I think that they can be held liable for, you know, lying to us or falsifying or, you know, delivering product. So,
yeah,
that's my
Frank. Frank, I really love the analogy you're making there. It's a really different way to think about social media. Will, I wonder if you can catch us up on the debate about how to regulate social media companies. Frank says, look, they're putting a product out there. They ought to be held as liable for that product as a grocery would be held. It doesn't really work that way. But talk about the push and pull, I guess, of the discussion about how and whether to hold social media platforms more responsible for what happens on them.
Yeah, I like the grocery analogy. It's creative. I mean, I see that analogy as being a little more apt for a platform like Amazon, right? Where it's a platform where just about anybody can sell stuff through Amazon. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can make the case that there's concern about the fact that some of those products aren't authentic, and you know, should Amazon be held more responsible for that? But I think when we talk about social media platforms, it's not as simple as saying, is it or is it not the public square? I mean, first of all, the public square is kind of a murky concept, right? Like none of us ever grew up with an actual public square where people held civil political debates all the time. I mean, it's kind of a mythical thing to start with. I mean, I think, you know, to the extent there is a public square in American life, it's a mixture of things. It's many things. It's the, you know, the floor speakers in Congress. Yes, it's politicians and the media on Twitter. It's the media more broadly. I mean, there are lots of things that make up the public square. There's local institutions. But I do think social media is part of it. It's a part of it. And it's a private company. You know, Facebook, Twitter, they're out to make money. And yet the product they offer is something that is used by influential people to shape discourse and to get their messages across and to test and focus group their messaging. So I think it does matter to society what people say on there. I think, you know, that your caller was referring, I believe, to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Mm-hmm. And this is a provision that said it was early in the development of the internet. And it cuts two ways. So it allows the platforms to not be held liable or not be considered the speaker of the stuff that their users say, right? So if I post something on Twitter, Section 230 says that Twitter, if you want to sue me for that, you can't sue Twitter as though Twitter was the speaker. I was the speaker, not Twitter. But what it also does is that it allows Twitter to moderate content as it sees fit. That's part of what 230 does as well. So you see
people from both the left and the right saying, well, we should get rid of these special protections for the internet companies. We actually don't know how that would play out in the courts. It could be that they would, you know, that they would stop moderating altogether and hope for, you know, they would try to become more like a common carrier, like a phone company where anybody could say anything. Or maybe they would be, you know, they would really tighten the ship, as your caller suggests, and get much more careful about their moderation of content so that they couldn't be sued. It would be a mess. We could say that for sure.
I really think that a lot of this debate comes down to whether you think these social media platforms essentially are publishers of the content that that's on them, or if they are carriers, as you point out, kind of like a telephone company. You know, if somebody calls you on the phone and says something really awful to you, You don't get mad at AT&T for conveying that call. And that's a really critical question that I think it's still really hard to answer, because social media is not really either or, it's kind of both.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a hybrid. If I could just quickly share my perspective. I mean, I think that the problem with thinking of social media companies like a common carrier, like a phone company, is that they are not just a host of information. I mean, they compete on how they curate that information, how they present it to you. All these features like, you know, retweets and likes, they have turned discourse into a game, really, and they have made it engaging and addictive to keep you coming back, and they have algorithms that decide which posts you see and which you don't. I think, you know, that is a fundamentally different thing from just being a phone company. And that is part of why that they find content moderation is critical to what they do, because otherwise the algorithms would just, you know, make all the worst stuff go viral, and it would be, you know, even more of a cesspool than it is today. Mm.
Again, Frank, really love the call and the provocative analogies there. Let's go next to Jason in Macomb County. Jason, welcome to the show. You there, Jason?
Let's go next to Jason.
Jason, you got to turn your radio down, bud. Are you there?
This is Jason.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to mention that maybe one of the things that kind of Frank was talking about there, because through the aggravation is being put out on Twitter, you know, the celebrities are famous. They need to be aware of the fact that they are famous and that people are going to follow them, and their information should be factual, and don't be spreading lies out there. You know, Elon Musk just tweeted the other day about how there's a asteroid or a comet coming toward Earth. Like, well, yeah, NASA did too, but they said also that it was not going to hit Earth.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to look at that and say, okay, well, we're all going to die. You know, it's that kind of stuff is needs to be noticed and say, hey, you know, I know what I'm doing here, but yet I need to maybe expand on that a little bit more or watch what I put. The other thing regarding earlier was talking about COVID, things being said about COVID, they're fake.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff people are going to read. They're going to be taking it in and realizing it, telling their friends, and you're going to have all these lies spread out in the world. That kind of stuff needs to be moderated for a reason.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that maybe should be done is have a terms contract when people sign up with Twitter that says, hey, this is what we want you not to put in here on our platform. And if you don't follow this, then there'll be consequences.
Yeah. Jason, I really appreciate the call and your perspective on this. Well, let's talk about fact and lies, and whether there are, I guess, brighter lines that could be drawn about the the proliferation of falsehoods on platforms like Twitter or other social media. Is there an easier way, as I think Jason is suggesting, to just say, look, you're going to be held responsible if you say something that's not true, even if it doesn't rise to the level of course, libel, right? If I say something untrue about somebody, there are laws to deal with that. But if I say, you know, there's an asteroid and it's going to hit Earth tomorrow, or it's coming this way and it might hit Earth, that's not true. But I really can't be sued for that. What is the standard that we should be thinking about?
That's right. The First Amendment in the United States protects our ability to lie, frankly. We can say things that aren't true and we're not going to get put in jail for them. There's good reasons for that, because who decides what's true, right? If you have an authoritarian regime, in Russia, for instance, right now, if you call their war in Ukraine a war instead of using their preferred term, which is a special military operation, you can be put in jail for that. We don't want that. Very few Americans want that. We like the First Amendment. We don't want to be sued or jailed for things we say, even if they're deemed a lie. Now, when we say it on social media, that's a different matter. It's not about getting prosecuted by the government. The question is, will the social media platforms allow us to lie or not? And about what things, and how will they determine whether we're lying or not? And that's something they've been wrestling with over the past 5 to 7 years. It's interesting. I asked Facebook way back in 2014 or 2015. They had these viral misinformation about miracle cures for cancer going around. You know, these sort of hoaxes. It wasn't yet a political dimension, but there were lots of hoaxes about how vaccines can give you all these illnesses and stuff. I said, do you ever think about maybe trying to make your social network a place where lies don't spread so easily? And they said, no, not really. That's never something we really thought about. You know, they just felt their job was to connect people and let people say what they wanted and not to intervene at all. And then the price of that over the years became clear. I mean, it became clear that the way these social platforms work, they actually reward lies and conspiracy theories. People who will tell you what you want to hear, even if it's not true, do really well on these platforms. So they found that in order to be completely overrun by lies, they actually did have to start trying to police at least certain narrow types of misinformation. So even today, you can lie on Twitter, you won't get booted off. But if you lie about a few specific things, if you lie about the efficacy of COVID vaccines, mm-hmm. if you lie about the election or how to vote, those things can get you suspended from Twitter. So they're carving out narrow categories where they say, these are lies we're not going to tolerate because they're specifically harmful to society, as opposed to all the other lies that, look, we're not going to be in the business of trying to figure out whether every one of the 10 million things people post on here today is true or false.
Yeah, yeah. So, Will, before we have to end the show, I want to cast you a little bit in the role of prognosticator here. Is Elon Musk really going to buy Twitter? Is that all going to work out, all the kinks that have popped up in the last few weeks? Or is this all just going to collapse? And then give me a prediction about what happens if he does end up as the owner.
There are a lot of topics. There's a lot of topics. We journalists try to be sort of balanced and objective, particularly in the news section. But there's a lot of topics where if you ask a journalist kind of after hours, what do you really think? They can just tell you, well, yeah, I think this is going to happen. But honestly, with Elon Musk, I do not know. I don't think anybody knows. I'm not even sure Elon Musk knows if he's definitely going to complete this deal or not. It's funny, the tables have turned now. I mean, first he was trying to buy the company and Twitter was trying to fight off his bid. Now it kind of feels like he's trying to back out or leverage the price down, and Twitter's trying to hold him to the bid. They've turned the tables. They're like, no, oh, you said you were going to buy us for this price. You got to stick with it. I have no idea what's going to happen here. I think, what seems clear at the moment is that he doesn't want to buy it for the price he agreed to buy it. How that plays out, nobody knows. If he does buy it, I think we'll continue to see a rightward shift on the platform. I think we'll see huge exodus of existing Twitter employees, because these are all people who have bought into the current idea that Twitter should be somewhat responsible for what people say on there, and that it should be somewhat responsible for trying to steer us toward more healthy conversations and truthful discourse. And if you get an owner who comes in and says, no, it's going to be anything goes, laissez-faire, free speech, all those people, the mission that they had is gone. So they're going to leave. The company's going to be in tatters. It's going to go through a really rough patch. Conservatives are going to rejoice. Liberals will probably flee. From there, whether Musk adjusts course and kind of steers it back toward a more moderated platform, or whether he keeps going down that path and Twitter just becomes a sort of more Wild West place again, I just don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Will Oramus, technology writer for The Washington Post. It was really great to have you here to help us sort through all of these issues around Elon Musk and Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, speaking of healthy discourse, I appreciate that you take the time to delve into topics like this. Thanks.
That's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when we're going to talk with prize-winning photojournalist Salwan Georges about his work and his experiences on the ground in Ukraine. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.